Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting writer and broadcaster Afua Hirsch to learn more about her new podcast series, which unpacks the tricky legacy of the British Empire.
Then we'll be discussing high art vandalism in the Gilded Age as we meet painter Darren Waterson.
And we'll be flipping through a new gender-bending comic, which uses the motifs of a Western to cast a wry look at machismo, with graphic novelist Reggae Villadson.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news and enjoy some fine music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Welcome, everybody. Oh, great to see you.
Thank you, Rob.
Looking beautiful as ever across the desk here at Studio One.
I'm glad you said that. I feel like I've let myself go a bit this January.
Yeah? What's that? What's going on?
My hair's too long. Yeah? My body's too fat.
I thought that this week. I've had a sort of week of eating in all my favourite places around Baker Street in some sort of small adieu to the place. And, yeah, I can feel myself rolling out the door. I rolled out the door on Friday.
A binge.
Rolled back in. Luckily, the studio entrance here in the radio part of Monocle is sort of like Rolling of the Rock kind of thing, isn't it? It's like a Star Trek door, but wrought in fine oak. That lets me through it. But some of the smaller apertures in this building might not let me in. How are you faring?
He's lying. He's a sylph-like, fine figure of a man. I fare fine.
I started the week like a waif and I've ended it up like a wrestler.
Mr. Creosote. What I'm sad about is that I've been living in a bit of a cultural wilderness, which is not to say that I haven't been enjoying,
can't
engaging.
Can't wait for the way this show's been programmed.
Oh, I don't mean that.
Okay.
This show is as brilliant as ever, strong and stable.
Brimming with ideas.
But I've been catching up with things. So I'm halfway through the second series of Succession, which I know you've seen.
Yeah.
I'm reading Gormenghast.
Okay.
About 70 years after its first publication.
70? Yeah, it's probably about
more
70.
More or less,
yeah,
I think. Yeah. So I kind of feel like I'm not at the bleeding edge where I like to spend my time.
But you're going between kind of Netflix, I know it's not Succession, it's Netflix, Sky One or whatever, series and a sort of classic of the gothic genre. Mm-hmm. I think you're skirting between two fine camps there.
And what is January 4?
You'll be listening to some drill music or something next, right? To kind of really get...
Skengdown AM, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I'm into that.
Are you familiar with drill music?
Yeah.
Okay. We have rolling news channels on, slightly irritating, in the office. And Drill Minister was on the Victoria Derbyshire show I saw on BBC Two. Are you familiar with Drill Minister's works? Is he the same man that does Pie Minister?
I'm not, and I'm not sure about that. Maybe he's the counterpart to Screaming Lord Sutch of the Monster Rally Looney Party.
Yeah, he was running for mayor, isn't he?
He's just making everyone else scream. Yeah, he's running for mayor. Drill music, listen, we can talk about this later, but in the same way as I like some of that quite grim, you know, early Nas, Mobb Deep, the pathos-heavy hip-hop in which young men explore the tragedy of their circumstances. I think it's very elegant. There's a lot of sort of strangled emotion in there, this kind of toxic masculinity that forces them into a life of gun. I think drill actually has quite a lot of the same elements. I don't know if you remember, there was a big move to ban it a couple of years ago.
I don't know how you ban a type of music.
With the courts, with court orders, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll vote for any man that wears balaclava on the TV. I mean, that's you can always trust that.
That right? sends you back to your youth, doesn't it? The heady days of the 80s. Let's move on from that, shall
that's a
we?
That's a tricky top of the show, isn't it? I don't know how we come back from that, other than by looking into our wonderful crystal ball, lightening the load, lightening the mood. There's only one man that can do that.
It's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that
night. The stars were bright, Fernando, welcome. Lovely to see you on a Sunday. You're bringing sunshine into Studio One here. What's happening next week, though?
First of all, I have to say sorry because this week, actually, it's looking very American. Usually I try to do, you know, things from all sorts of continents. But, you know, the US, you know, is a big deal this week. And we start today. It's the something, actually, again, I don't know much about it, but it's the Super Bowl. And I've been doing research because, you know, why I got interested in Super Bowl? Because of their incredible halftime shows. And, you know, I'm a big fan of popular culture. And guys, the halftime show is almost as important as the match, you know, because, you know, a lot of people don't even know the rules of American football.
It's easier to follow, isn't it?
It's easier to follow. It's like 10 minutes of a great pop star doing an incredible show. I mean, more than 100 million Americans watch the show live every single year. So it's such a great opportunity. And of course, today the match will be in Miami, will be between the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs.
Okay.
I don't want to predict because I don't know who is actually playing the best.
May the best man win.
San Francisco 49ers are sort of one of the old big teams, aren't they? They're kind of like, I think, talking about the 80s again, Org. They were big in the 80s, weren't they? They seem like Dallas Cowboys kind of era.
A welcome return.
Yeah. This is not the most pressing question, though. Is the halftime performance, is it kept under wraps? Do we know who's delivering it this year? Administering it?
It's going to be good, and I think it matches Miami perfectly. It's going to be J-Lo and Shakira.
Wow. I mean, wow, I'd see that.
You know what I mean? I'm very happy about it.
Yeah.
And you know another thing that I quite like during Super Bowl is the ads, because I think companies, you know, they pay millions, you know, to have an ad there, and usually they invest. They're usually quite funny ads. Mm. Some of them are quite rubbish, of course. And there's one in particular, actually, which, again, is good for my next story as well. Michael Bloomberg apparently spent $11 million in an ad that would be, you know, showcased during Super Bowl. I mean,
Small change for him as well.
Yeah. And again, that takes me to our next story, which is happening tomorrow, is the Iowa caucuses. Mm. And, you know, they're super important. You know, it's the first time where the Democratic candidates will be tested. But again, last time we just had two, basically, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And even though Hillary, I think she got a little bit more, they were like 49% each, more or less. But this time, you know, it's, you know, we have Bernie Sanders. I think he's in the lead. You know, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg. And who knows, Michael Bloomberg, if people were happy with his special Super Bowl ad as well.
Yeah, because if all that happened and then people actually voted in Shakira.
I would vote for her.
I'm a J-Lo man.
J-Lo, kind of as vice president.
So look, who do we fancy for the nomination?
Because, you know, one interesting thing, before I tell you who I fancy, you know, I think American sports and American politics, they're quite similar. They both have a lot of numbers, you know, because I'm not here to explain to you how the Iowa caucuses work, because it's incredibly complex, you know, the way they vote. I think, listeners, please, you know, go and read the many articles trying to explain. It's the same for me when I watch American sports. There's so many numbers on the screen that I get a bit confused.
That's right.
Do you guys have a favorite? I mean, the Democratic nominees, or do you think who has a chance, perhaps, you know, to get Iowa?
I kind of think the only person that could probably beat him is Michael Bloomberg, actually.
Interesting. Og?
A bit of a Bernie bro, as you might have guessed. Faye. I just like him. I think he's
solid. I'd go for a cup of tea with Bernie, for sure.
I go with Elizabeth Warren, actually. Even though I have to be honest, I did one of those stupid tests, who I agree more. Apparently, Michael Bloomberg was my choice.
Yeah, he's tough, but I think you can't. You've got to know who you're going up against, right?
More interestingly, more pressingly, though, obviously, this is a pretty good lineup, but perfect dream team halftime show. I think you must have an answer for that. And it can't be Madonna, can it? She's done it, hasn't she?
She's done it. And she could do it again, in my opinion. But I think, come on, J-Lo and Shakira is a good one.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's very Miami, very good for the Latino community. But guys, my last story here. Do you know the Golden Raspberry Awards, or the Razzies, right?
Oh, is this for the worst films?
Exactly.
Okay.
Traditionally, you know, they give away the awards one day before the Oscars.
Yeah.
But this year, on Saturday the 8th, which is one day before the Oscars, actually, they are nominating the films. So I think it's changing, because the Oscars are a little bit earlier in the year. So we don't know what's going to happen. But for the first time, they will broadcast the show live on TV as well. We don't know specifically the date. It's going to be live on Comedy Dynamics Network. I don't know how big is that network. Do you have a worse film? Because, I mean, I think Cats would dominate the list. And did you guys ever see Serenity with Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway?
No.
It was released like in January last year. It was so terrible.
I've never even heard of it.
Well, precisely. Yeah, I mean, it's a mix of sci-fi, kind of erotic thriller, and for me, it's not the worst, but it is quite weird. I presume there will be some nominations for Serenity as well.
I don't think I've seen any real clangers this year, have you?
Cats was pretty awful. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you've been sending me some quite sort of fruity Nicolas Cage bits and bobs.
Hey, look, if you saw Mandy and you enjoyed it, which everyone did.
Did you like Bad Lieutenant, the Miami one?
Yeah.
Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog.
See, that was amazing. And that's in that kind of vein. Anyway, I think it's probably going to be Cats, right, this year?
It'll be Cats. I mean, it was made for this.
It is literally, the award could literally be a small animal licking its privates.
I do actually love these kind of up yours, that was a stinker awards, and it because it always reminds me of a sort of rave outfit, the KLF,
who were big
in the UK in the '90s, who on the occasion of one Turner Prize announced that they were also going to be awarding a prize for the worst artist of the year. And they were going to award it on the steps of Tate Modern, where the Turner Prize, and it was double the prize. It was £50,000, and they awarded it to Rachel Whiteread, who won the Turner Prize that year, who refused to come out and accept the award until they said that if she didn't, they were going to incinerate the £50,000 on the steps of the Tate Modern. Forced her out. And she had to come and get this award for being the worst artist.
She's excellent, Rachel Whiteread, but also the KLF. I don't know whose side I'm on with that.
I know, it's tough, isn't it?
They did burn £1 million, didn't they, in a castle in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. Not very Bloomberg, quite Bernie. Thanks, as ever, Fernando, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. You at home are listening to The Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be talking to writer and broadcaster Afua Hirsch about her new podcast series.
Monocle's February issue extols the virtues of a gentler life. You won't be surprised to learn that it's full of stories like these. First, we visit Colombia's newest city, an experiment in privately funded urbanism where we measure the temperature in cycle paths, bright-eyed schools, fresh residential thinking, and smiles. Second, we profile a handful of people who are living the dream, who've quit the office to successfully pursue art, baking, beekeeping, and hospitality. Do give up the day job. Third, we head down Miami Way to meet Don and Mira Rubel, the city's most important and sunnily dispositioned art collectors, as they open a beautiful new place to show their museum standard art collection. Fourth, we meet Amanda Lear in Paris for her last meal. She eats blueberry tart at Le Meurice and gossips poetically about disco, Dali and Bowie. Fifth, we unveil our cover story at the top, Monocle's gentle manifesto that encourages taking the scenic route, a little reflection, jazz records by Bill Evans, putting your hands in your pockets and growing your own. Monocle's February issue is out now to order at monocle.com or be wise and subscribe. On Friday, Britain bid a final farewell to the EU, with much of the discussion wrapped up in jingoistic nostalgia. Now is perhaps a fitting time to reflect on the superstructure that, for some, continues to represent great in Great Britain, the British Empire.
Journalist and author Afua Hirsch has teamed up with Audible for a new six-part podcast series, We Need to Talk About the British Empire. It weaves an exploration of history through conversations with cultural figures who have themselves been touched by the legacy of the empire to shine a light on Britain's often less than glorious past.
Afua sat down with Monocle's Paige Reynolds and began by telling us why personal stories are so key to this project and just how she went about selecting them. First, though, let's hear a clip.
Imagine a girl from Doncaster having staff all of a sudden. My mother, I remember telling me how extraordinarily pompous life out there was, that the other wives would visit in the afternoon and leave visiting cards. Can you imagine the horror? She hadn't got a clue as to what to do.
So were many of the other English officers and their wives from more posh families in England?
Yes, very much so.
So your mother must have felt a bit out of place.
Yeah, totally, completely. And where to start, you know, and how to find a friend in all this ritual. It was really quite formal and, of course, a great deal of snobbery. The lowest of the low was if you were in trade. That was just not a good profession or, you know, way to be. And my father, in the pecking order, was not very high up at all.
I think that people's lived experiences are by far the most accessible, but also the most powerful way of telling this story. And I think we sometimes talk about history in a really detached way. And the point about the empire is that it's not, as some people claim, ancient history. It's so recent. There are so many of us, and I do include myself in this, although the series isn't about me. There are so many of us who live with the inherited memory and the opportunity, because that's part of the story of empires, that it did give people opportunities, but it also came at a cost. you know, that cost varied according to place and according to class and according to gender. And, you know, there are so many different ways people experience empire, but there are many forms of trauma that have also been handed down. And I think we don't talk about any of it. You know, we don't talk about the story of white working class boys from England finding that this was the only real route to social mobility, which is an incredibly important story about contemporary British history. But we also don't talk about the legacy of partition and how people have inherited so much trauma and dysfunction from that incredibly traumatic event. So I wanted to put people at the center of this because they are still living with this history every day. And it's impossible not to be compelled and moved by that when you actually hear their stories. And in terms of who we spoke to, I thought it was really important to choose people who are already well known, not because I think their stories are more valuable than other people's stories, far from it. But it makes the point that there are people all around us, many of whom are household names, who we know and who we follow, who actually live with this history. And we would never know it were it not for a program like this really shining a light on that. And I think that really says something about how invisible but omnipresent this history is in Britain. That's the reality that we all inhabit. And I think that it's unhealthy not to speak about it. It's like a ghost that lurks all around us, but we tiptoe around and try to ignore. So I wanted to, in any small way, try and take a step towards shining a light on that darkness in this series.
It also seems like the release date of this podcast, you know, just under 2 weeks after Britain officially leaves the European Union, isn't exactly a coincidence. Did Brexit bring kind of a certain urgency to your desire to talk about Britain's colonial legacy?
I do think that the empire is the elephant in the room in the entire Brexit drama. I think that this whole desire to kind of get sovereignty back and almost make Britain great again stems from a longing for a time when British people felt that this was the most powerful nation in the world. It was the most powerful nation in the world a century ago. And the reason it was the most powerful nation in the world is because of the British Empire. It's the reason we won both world wars. It's the reason that we have a seat at the Security Council table. It's the reason that we have been so overrepresented in world politics, despite being a small island nation in the North Sea. We have punched so disproportionately above our weight because of the empire. And I think that when we talk about going it alone post-Brexit, you know, there was a lot of talk about being friends with Europe and having new trade relations and new trade deals. All of those relate to this history of empire. We've never really gone it alone. There's no memory of what it was like to be alone. And a huge part of the reason is because of the empire, because for 400 years, we had this system of dominion over a huge swathe of the world. So I'm not trying to make a political point about Brexit, really. I just think that it's important to know the facts and to know how this history informs our perspective.
And I'm intrigued whether you've actually thought about using this podcast in an educational sense, doing a podcast tour around schools, trying to lobby educators. I don't know if that's something you've considered.
I think about it a lot, and I think there's a huge problem with the way we teach history in schools. My experience was basically we learnt about the Tudors and then we leapfrogged to the 20th century. It's kind of a coincidence. That bit we left out was the bit around the transatlantic slave trade, colonising the Americas and then colonising Asia, Africa and large parts of the world. That's been completely absent from my education. And I speak to people older than me and I speak to people younger than me, and it seems that's largely still the case. And when we do talk about things like the transatlantic slave trade, which is often confined to one month of the year, October, which is Black History Month in Britain, we do it through the lens of abolition. So celebrating Britain's role in ending these atrocities rather than any attempt at an honest look at how Britain pioneered and built and industrialized off the back of it. So there's a profound dishonesty in the way we teach education. I talk and write about that quite a lot. And actually, one consequence of that is that teachers have contacted me saying that they teach, for example, Key Stage 2 children aged around 8, they teach them the Victorians, and they would like to decolonize the way they teach. I think we are in need of actual practical tools for people who want to equip a new generation with better tools to talk about this history and to understand it. So if this could be used in schools, that'd be great. And I haven't actually thought about it that much. I'm thinking more widely about how I can contribute to the people who want to update the way we teach. And I would love for this to be part of that answer.
So to talk more specifically about the podcast, the first episode is about British rule in India, the British Raj. And one thing I noticed in particular about this episode was that you spoke solely with women. I wondered whether there was an intention behind this or whether you think the storytelling gets done differently when there are women voices at the fore.
It was absolutely crucial to me to talk to women for this series and hear women's voices. I mean, Empire affected women in the most radical way. You know, it imported a British, Christian, European, Western capitalist, individualist approach to everything from the market economy to land ownership to marriage norms to sexual codes of conduct. I mean, every area of life in places colonized by the British was changed according to British norms. And that has had such a huge impact, including on my own family who come from Ghana, which was the British colony, the Gold Coast. So I really wanted to explore that and how that's affected people's lives and experience. And it's a complicated story, a really complicated story, because everywhere colonized by the British adopted British ideas to very different degrees, and in some cases not very much, but it still changed the power dynamic. It still disempowered women who had benefited from pre-colonial forms of power and economic power. There's still a lot more to tell in this story. And this is what's so interesting about this subject. I mean, this series, I learned things that I have never heard, and I think it really does break new ground in bringing experiences of empire to the fore. But there's so much still to tell. So in a way, I see this as the beginning of a conversation, by no means the end of it.
And it seems even the people telling these stories have gone through this learning process, unearthing a family secret to get to the bottom of their histories. You know, the majority of the storytellers you spoke with were also one or two generations removed from the actual experience of empire. And that's interesting too, as many note that their grandparents were too stoic perhaps to tell their truth, or hesitant to fully denounce it as they reaped some kind of benefit from it. There's this complicated sense of gratitude.
I think that's such a fascinating subject. It is really complicated. We're understanding more and more about how trauma works and how things, memory and pain, is passed down intergenerationally. And I think that that applies far beyond the British Empire. I think that's maybe quite a universal human phenomenon that we're only just beginning to unpick. And I'm absolutely fascinated by it, because having had Jewish refugees from the Nazis on one side of my family and essentially Ghanaian refugees from post-independence Ghana on the other side of my family, I think that there's so much that I've inherited. But as is so often the case with these things, your parents or grandparents don't sit you down and tell it to you. They often have created a silence around it, which is part of their own coping mechanism, and you often have to unearth it for yourself. And I think it's a very layered experience, and it also makes for a very layered series in this Audible series, because the people that I've spoken to are people that you think you know. And then when you hear this side of their story, you realize that there is all this that you didn't know about them. But you're also listening to them tell you how they thought they knew themselves. And in the process of uncovering these aspects of colonial history, they've realized things about themselves they didn't know, and their parents and their grandparents that they didn't know. And these things were often present, and there were signs and clues, but they were somehow just out of reach, and it's a kind of lifelong process of unearthing them. So again, I think this is a complicated story, and I think it goes far deeper than we usually give airtime for. So I hope this will start people thinking in a different way about the identities that we all have, and how the past that we have not been talking about, we haven't been learning in schools, how that past informs us.
Yeah, it feels definitely like the sort of tip of the iceberg, the more you think about it and then the more you uncover. What I am interested in is, for one of the episodes, you actually talked to someone who was sort of on the other side of the British Empire, actress Diana Rigg, who's a dame of the British Empire. You know, how did you go about in choosing Diana Rigg, and how did you go about including that story, and how important, I suppose, was it to have that balance or that nuance to it?
I think it was really important to hear Diana Rigg's story, because it's the story that we also don't hear. And I've certainly focused on the colonized in my work. But Diana Rigg's story is just as important, you know, and her father was born working class without very great prospects, but being able to go to India and work on the railways as a supervisor and get promoted opened up a whole new world of opportunity and essentially propelled his family up through the class system in Britain. And that kind of social mobility wasn't really available without going and working in the empire. And I think we forget that. The empire was hugely important for ordinary British people. And that's part of our collective memory as well that I think we shy away from. And for me, this isn't about allocating blame. It's not about saying that someone like Diana Rigg is bad because her father went from being really underprivileged in Britain to being unfairly privileged over Indians in India, which was the imperial system, that you had this kind of superiority because you were white and British. It's just about understanding the privilege that that confers and how it works and what the legacy is and how we deal with it. And Diana Rigg deals with it in a very specific way. I mean, she is a dame of the empire, so she's not rejected the imperial system. But I think if you listen to her interview, you'll see some quite complicated feelings. I think she bears a certain amount of guilt, and she's dealt with it by engaging in charity and going back to India and feeling a sense of responsibility for the part of India that she grew up in and being raised by all of these Indian maids and servants. And I think the emphasis here is on conversation. I don't think starting to unpick this history of empire is about people blaming people or people claiming the moral upper hand. I genuinely want to understand it, and I think that is the important first step. So I've tried to give everybody the same treatment of just listening to their story and asking them questions, in some cases quite tough questions, which I think it's important to do. And I hope that people will make up their own minds.
And finally, I suppose, what's the thing that's sort of stayed with you the most since finishing the podcast process? What do you think you've learned, or maybe what are you going to kind of do in the future in podcasting? And most importantly, Afua, are you braced for the Twitter trolls? Because I'm sure they'll come.
I'm always braced for the Twitter trolls because I don't have to do anything for them to come. I mean, just the fact that I exist seems to be enough to trigger them. So, you know, it's quite liberating because in a way I can do or say what I want. It doesn't really make it any worse than it is just by the fact that I am alive in the world. And I also do get a huge amount of support and people who follow and value my work. So that's the flip side of it. And it's such an honour to be doing something that I feel people do value and are hungry for now. And people from all races, backgrounds, generations, that there really is a genuine desire to hear these stories and understand this past. So I feel very lucky to be part of telling those stories. And I can certainly see myself doing more in this vein, not to give any spoilers. This Audible series is about people who live among us, many of whom we know and follow and see all the time on TV or read about. And they're living with this too. And I think that's the most incredible thing about this history. It has so much to tell us in the present. One of the people I interviewed, Emmy the Great, she's a singer who was born in Hong Kong just before it was handed over. So she's probably the last generation to have been born in the empire. And it's so present. I'm fascinated by it, as I hope you can hear. So I do want to do more work on it. There are so many stories to tell and so many different types of storytelling to do. I'm a journalist, so I often write and investigate this history. But I think this kind of series where you really give people time to speak and tell their stories is a brilliant way into it. And I think that there's a lot of room for drama and film and creative storytelling as well. So watch this space.
That was Afua Hirsch talking to Monocle's Paige Reynolds. And Afua's new podcast, We Need to Talk About the British Empire, is out on Audible from the 13th of February. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. It's time for some new music, Rob.
Yes, please.
We're actually having some new music this week. With this fifth album, Hoving into View on the horizon. Do you like Ghost Poet?
Yeah, I do like Ghost Poet.
I love Ghost Poet. Here's his new single, Concrete Pony.
That was Concrete Pony, new from Ghost Poet. And you are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Monocle's free-to-subscribe daily email newsletters, the Monocle Minute and Weekend Edition, deliver news and a swathe of recommendations from our editors, correspondents and bureau. You can also browse a menu of radio highlights and new Monocle films. Our weekend newsletter delivers great columns from Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck, wardrobe advice from our fashion team, places to stay and eat, odd news from even odder places, and some reminders of how to behave in public from Mr. Etiquette and his feline sidekick, Mr. Tiddly. It's a fun take on weekend living. This new addition to your weekend is available for free. Head to monocle.com/minute. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, Darren Waterston is one of the state's leading painters. His expressive, dreamlike abstracts have been exhibited around the world, while his work is held in institutions across the US.
His latest exhibition in London sees him engage with one of the true greats of the American painterly canon, James Whistler. At London's V&A, Waterston has installed Filthy Lucre, a direct, immersive, installational response to one of the old painter's best-known works.
Monocle's Georgina Godwin caught up with Darren to learn more about his career as a painter and his interest in Whistler's great masterpiece, The Peacock Room.
I'm primarily known as a painter, and my studio practice is primarily oil on panel paintings, but I have been doing installation work that is also painterly in its approach for the last 15 years as well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, having a look at your CV, you've been exhibited widely across America.
Yes, I have terrific galleries I work with and have had the privilege to work with amazing museums. And here I am in London. It's thrilling.
You also had a lot of work in your earlier career in Germany.
Yes, I did. I studied in Munster and in Berlin in my undergraduate studies. And I studied mostly art history and focused in illuminated manuscripts and documents was something I had great interest in and still do. But that was sort of my focus.
Gosh, that's quite niche, isn't it?
It is a bit niche. But I think as a painter, I was so interested in the history of materials and the materials of the Renaissance and the Renaissance studio. So that also became partly involving works on paper as well. So that's where I began that interest.
So, I mean, that must be quite difficult because then you're looking for stuff that possibly doesn't even exist anymore, or you're having to make materials that artists these days would just buy.
It's true. My studio practice is very much affected by that or informed by that just because I use materials that are not obsolete to find, but are somewhat unusual in normal contemporary painting studio.
Mm. Well, this current exhibition at the V&A owes a lot to history, too. I want you to give us the background, please. Let's go back to 1877, and we're looking at James McNeill Whistler and his masterpiece of interior decoration, The Peacock Room. Tell us about the original piece and how it came about and the controversy that it caused.
Yes, James McNeill Whistler was an American, and he came to London as a young man and a very sort of ambitious artist and quickly found his way to a group of patrons that were very enthusiastic about his work. And he was quite a personality. And he really is one of the earliest artists to have this sort of preoccupation with the cult of the artist and the personality of the artist. And he really found his way into, as often as he could, into these rather controversial feuds and lawsuits and tabloids, the newspapers. And he was a purveyor of good taste and always had an opinion to say about what people were wearing or what art they were collecting. And his one patron who he was quite close with, Leyland, Frederick Leyland, who is a British shipping magnate who had quickly came into money, and he...
Or as the British would go, nouveau.
Yeah, exactly. And so he was trying to surround himself with the cultural kind of elite of London at the time. And so finding a well-known artist for him was kind of part of his own education. So he and Whistler became very close friends, and he was close with the family as well. And he had access to the home of Leyland, which was on Princess Gate, which is just around the corner, actually, from the Victoria and Albert Museum. And in this very beautiful row of mansions where Leyland lived, he had commissioned this beautiful interior by a well-known interior architect named Thomas Jekyll, who was the absolute star of interior design and architecture of the time. And he spent an enormous amount of money to commission this one room, of which Whistler was given a commission to paint sort of the main paintings in the room. And so Whistler did not like what the interior design looked like that was surrounding his painting. So he thought that Jekyll's design was a bit twee and just did not fit the brilliance of his work. I mean, he was really a handful, Whistler. And so when the family was away in Liverpool for the summer, Leyland found his way into the home and painted over everything that this interior architect had done. He really did literally completely override the vision of this interior architect and painted over every surface, the ceiling, the floors. He took 3 months and did it in a very discreet way to where no one really knew exactly what he was up to. But while he was doing this, he was also like then started to invite press and have people come and see what he was doing. All along, Leyland has no idea what's happening other than there's something going on in his house. And Whistler said to him, "I have a beautiful surprise awaiting you." So finally, the patron, Leyland, comes back to discover that his room has been completely painted over every surface by Whistler. And he's appalled, and he's quite angry. And Whistler hands him the bill. He said, "This is my masterpiece, and here's the bill. And I've given you one of my great works of art." And thus the feud begins between this artist and patron. And it becomes this very heartbreaking story of friendship gone awry and egos completely over-exaggerated around who is responsible for this, who should be paid. And it becomes this kind of very sad story. But bigger than that, it really is a story of art and money, which is kind of the story of art. And it's when you really think about the way in which art comes about and patronage and commissions from the church to private patrons to, there's always been the necessity of a monetary exchange in order for works of art to exist. Mm. So all of this said, this story, as I began my research about Whistler and the Peacock Room, I felt like it really was contemporary, and it felt very much like what living artists have to navigate through in the contemporary world today, that's so saturated with art and this kind of frenzy of amassing art collections and objects and the auctions and the art fairs and the, in a certain way, this was playing out in the Gilded Age when Whistler was painting the Peacock Room, and we are sort of living in our own Gilded Age of this kind of excess and also this incredible deprivation that all of this is playing out in. So it was a very poignant story of Whistler's, of this particular relationship with his patron, but I felt there was a bigger story to be told that was really looking around art collecting and the kind of, at what point does this become just too much?
And so your piece is called Filthy Lucre. As you've described, that's exactly why it's called that. It's about the transactional nature of art, I suppose. But tell us now how you have used that original story and that original artwork. What is it we will see when we go to the V&A?
Yes, well, I took the original footprint and all the details of the original of the Peacock Room and reimagined them into a kind of splendid ruin of sorts. And the piece itself is somewhat an architectural sculpture of sorts. I mean, you walk into a freestanding building that is the room. And so I, with a group of extraordinary artisans and engineers and craftspeople, we reproduced almost to scale. It's just about 10% smaller than the original. But we took Whistler's Peacock Room and with incredible detail, we reproduced the interior, but in a state of kind of decadent ruin. So it's proportionately correct. And so many of the details, which are so sumptuous and beautiful in Whistler's Peacock Room, I mean, it's really a jaw-droppingly beautiful room. But it does have this kind of excess to it. It's sort of the excess of beauty, the excess of objects. So my piece, Filthy Lucre, is as much as it is an homage to Whistler, it is a critique of this kind of consumption and the volatility of beauty and our own perceptions of beauty and the grotesque and how those things can be inexplicably tied.
What a wonderful concept. I wonder if you have any answers.
I don't know if I have any answers. I feel like this piece is really, it's about an interrogation and a question. And maybe it's just maybe shifting the lens a little bit to get some insight for all of us who are involved in a world that we all have to navigate through where there is this kind of, you know, living in a time of such extraordinary wealth and also such hardship. And the Gilded Age was this time of just such extraordinary decadence. And I feel that Filthy Lucre is trying to kind of look back to this time of the aesthetic movement, that look back to this time of where there was this frenzy of collecting, particularly in the art world, and be somewhat contemplative around it in terms of this moment.
Thanks to Darren Waterston and Georgina Godwin. And Darren's installation, Filthy Lucre, is on display at the V&A in London until May. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
We've been thinking a lot about food at Monocle, particularly as we applied the finishing touches to our brand new drinking and dining directory, which is on newsstands now. Within the magazine's 200-odd glossy pages, we've surveyed our 50 favourite places to eat in our restaurant awards, plus dispatched hungry reporters in six continents. They came back with food scoops from the quirky, think iceberg cowboys in Newfoundland, to the thoughtful, cue the food folk looking to revive the Algarve's package holiday image with something tastier. All before plans of relocating to Ojai in California, plus a survey of Vienna's city vineyards and mulling over how to host at home. Oh, and did we mention the 30-plus recipes we've laid on? Ours is an opportunity-orientated glimpse at the world of food, where restaurateurs, bakers and distillers done good offer us their tips for jacking in the day job and starting a food-focused endeavour. We also hone in on the markets and department stores that are reviving brick-and-mortar retail, and in which battalions of smaller producers are creating better products, plus doing so transparently and with a lot less waste. For all that and more, you can buy Monocle's Drinking and Dining Directory, and we suggest you should. It's on newsstands, or you can subscribe at monocle.com today. Now it's time for our semi-regular look into the world of comics.
They are graphic novels, Rob.
Okay, I mean, I presume this is we're nudging towards one of your secret passions here.
One of my many secret passions, yes, indeed. Rege Willadsen is a Danish graphic novelist. With her instantly recognisable style, she draws on symbolism and pop culture to spin strange tales that resonate far beyond the page.
Rege's latest book is Cowboy, a surreal, bawdy riff on the Western that draws on the dialogue and motifs of some of the genre's classics to explore and subvert the hyper-masculinity for which it's known.
I caught up with Rege to learn more. Rege, thank you so much for joining me on the Monocle Weekly, and congratulations on your new graphic novel, Cowboy. It's a really singular comic. It's beautifully illustrated. The language is really novel and is drawn, I think, from Westerns. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about the background, how you came to decide to write a graphic novel set in the Wild West.
It was back in 2014. There was some movies came up at that time, Django and True Grit. It was kind of remakes of old Westerns, and I truly loved them and always been fond of Westerns. And it's a kind of a very stereotypical genre, I would say. The comic book are a medium that's really excellent for kind of taking a genre and turn it upside down, or taking a different view on a genre, I guess. Yeah.
I was going to ask about your relationship to the Western. You mentioned those two films, Django and True Grit there. Are they a part of your formative years? Did you grow up watching Westerns? How long have you kind of been thinking about them as a cultural space where masculinity is kind of defined as an archetype?
Yeah, I think aesthetically, I remember from my childhood the spaghetti Westerns. Like these very dusty, brownish, very beautiful films with Clint Eastwood. And I think I wanted to go and see how can I kind of make a pastiche to this genre. And I wanted to kind of see what is the typical masculine role in these pictures and what's left for the female. And that was just an obvious scene of doing this because it's so stereotypical, and so the masculinity is so too much, and it's a cliche, right? So it's also the spaghetti Westerns that are my reference. And as you may have noticed, most of the characters in Cowboy, their lines are kind of, they are taken from old classic spaghetti Westerns. I'm not sure if you'll be able to recognize it because it's out of context, but the lines are kind of a cut up, and that gave all the male characters in my graphic novel a kind of a stiff and strange sound to it. They're not real. They are cultural references.
It also seems like, you know, Westworld has been a very popular TV series, and before that was a kind of cult film. And as you say, the male characters in the book become these archetypes who speak robotically. It even seems to reach out culturally to that kind of narrative where cowboys are robots, you know, they're kind of avatars of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that, I guess that's really my intention, is to look at the narratives around us and how we are telling stories and kind of how stereotypical that is, and make it different or queer it or deconstruct it. Also to in the search for a different way of telling stories.
One of the things you mentioned a moment ago was the beauty of the cinematography of the Western. You know, these open plains, deserts, the landscape of the West of America. And I wondered a bit about your decisions when you were drawing this, because actually, for the most part, the scenes in which it takes place, while they're all very recognisably drawn from the Western genre, whether they're saloons or anything like this, these kind of cliche sets in which the action takes place, you kept it all quite close. It's sort of lots of dark rooms, or if it's not dark rooms, it's very infrequently the open vistas of the desert. And I wondered why you chose to do that.
Actually, I'm not really sure, but as you say, it comes to me that, yeah, the minute she sets off and rides off into the horizons, it's kind of a dead end. So they never really leave that small setting. It's an interesting question. Why do I keep it that kind of small? It's also, it's the setting is actually just one house. You can't really call it a town. I guess to narrow it down and stay in a particular place like that is to kind of focus more on the characters than on the story, because the story is not a plot like you expect it to be. The story is to raise different questions, right? And take a closer look at the characters involved.
To move on to the graphic novel as a form, this isn't your first, of course. Your previous one, The Sea, was also published in Denmark, and then again by Fantagraphics, who published this in English. What is it about the graphic novel as a form that you find it a useful platform to kind of explore these conceptual ideas within this framework of narrative?
Well, I think what it offers is that you can make it visual, like look like a setting and refer to other like movies or even also contemporary art or ways of style in drawing. And then it has this ability to kind of stop and do something completely different. For example, it's possible that a character suddenly speaks directly to the reader. And of course, that's seen also in movies as well. But I think that the comic as a medium is just very rare, because it contains the possibility of making a comment on cultural inheritance, I guess, and the culture that's around us in a different way.
Do you think that kind of cultural assessment, is that something that you're proceeding with in your next work? Are you going to kind of engage with another aspect of culture subversively, as you have here with the cowboy film?
My work will always be in Danish edition first. So I just had a new book out in Denmark. Hopefully you will see that in a while, in English as well. But so starting a new book now, I'm considering the film noir, which is also something that is filled with cliches and very typical aesthetics. And yeah, so it's very new. And very interesting, I think, to see all these old movies and read a lot about it and find the way in. Yeah.
That's great. You're definitely giving yourself a lovely bit of homework to do, engaging with all those old films. When you're doing this, I'm just interested to know, as you say, you're looking for a way in. You're looking for a way to engage with the set of ideas that you're interested in before you have a story to tell. Is that right?
Yeah. Mainly my focus is that how can I tell a different story and maybe kind of not only deconstruct the very male gaze or the masculine way of telling, but also searching for a new language, a new way of telling stories, and maybe a new role for the female characters. Being anti-heroes and being doubtful and being in doubt with identity and the social constructions and the gender constructions that we live with. Yeah. So that's kind of a, you could say, a feminist project.
My thanks to Rege Villadsen, and her new book, Cowboy, is out at the start of March, published by The Great Fantagraphics. You're with the Monocle Weekly, just...
Just indeed, because that was edition 552, count them, of the Monocle Weekly org. Lovely spending an hour in the studio with you today. A fun show, a little bit of audio gold to dig our teeth into.
Some nuggets in there, for
sure. Courtesy of Afua Hirsch. Darren Waterston, that's good. Filthy Luca. I'm looking forward to getting down to the V&A and do that. Nice to hear Georgina Godwin on the Monocle Weekly.
And I also look forward to going to Kensington for a trip to the Peacock Rooms. It's kind of your stomping ground, I imagine.
I used to live there. I used to have a very good time there. No longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Greenwich man now, aren't you?
Greenwich.
Yeah. Very good. Well, listen, let's say some thank you, shall we?
Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Org produced today's show, and our long-suffering stoic of a studio manager. Hi, Maylie. With Maylie Evans.
The Monocle Weekly will be back as ever next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Augusta Macellari.
And it's goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
Bye.
Bye.